everyone. John Wertheim. It's this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. It is Wednesday in the U.S., Thursday in Australia, but we don't have to do that conversion anymore. The 2021 Australian Open is in the books, and to wrap up the tournament and spin the tennis calendar forward in this crazy season, I'm joined by Jamie. Jamie, nice to be in the same time zone as you for the first time in a while. How are you?
I'm good. How's it going? Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm honestly, it's not really jet lag per se. I'm still a little off from having woken up at 3:30 a.m. Eastern, 12:30 Pacific time to watch these finals, which we can talk about that going forward. I think this is a part of what makes the Australian Open fun to follow from the United States, but also a bit problematic, at least in terms of the broadcast, is just the fact that 99.9% of the United States is asleep while these matches are going on. But why don't we just jump right in? The first major of 2021 was a weird one. It's in the books. I hope the Tennis Australia staff is catching up on some sleep. They deserve a round of applause, a beer, and a week on a beach. But the one thing I did not hear was people saying, boy, they never should have taken this risk. It would have been better off if we hadn't held this event. And I think we talked about this a few weeks ago. Predictably, hard quarantines and bad Uber Eats and Bernard Tomic's girlfriend washing her own hair, that all sort of molted like snakeskin. And we were left with Novak Djokovic and Naomi Osaka winning majors, which seemed like a pretty normal place to be on the final weekend of the first major of the year.
Definitely. I totally agree. I think all in all, beyond the, as always, like you said, the strange and difficult to watch time zone and broadcast times, it was, the tournament sort of ended up as one might have predicted. Definitely in the case of the men's side with Novak Djokovic, I mean, 9 Australian Opens, as Medvedev called it, or called him, as well as the rest of the big three, cyborgs in the best way possible. I mean, it's incredible. And I think, you know, Medvedev is part of that next gen, younger gen generation. But even he said, you know, I'm 25 years old, and to win 9 Australian Opens, I would need to win every year until I'm 34. And he kind of said, you know, I'm confident, I believe in myself, but come on, that's a little crazy. And so just puts it into perspective. And it's really interesting to hear a huge, big time player on the men's side to have that sort of perspective about Djokovic and the big three.
If you were to do that, just keep, you know, if we play along with this silly hypothetical and he wins every Australian Open until he's 34 years old, he would still be at only half the haul of Novak Djokovic's overall majors, and of course, right, would be less than half of Federer Nadal. I think we are in for a serious reset in terms of tennis math. I mean, there's one male player under the age of 30 that's won a major right now, and that's Dominic Thiem, who won his when Nadal didn't play, Federer didn't play, and Novak Djokovic was defaulted. Yeah, it's going to be, I mean, we can jump ahead to Osaka in a bit. People talking about, well, she won double-digit majors. We are in for a major sort of math recalibration when these three titans leave, because they're winning everything in sight. And we're going to go back to the days when a player winning 3 or 4, you know, Jim Courier won 4 majors and had a great career, got to number one, was a no-brainer Hall of Famer. That's where we're going to revert to the mean pretty soon here. And people going to tennis matches and expecting to see players win double-digit majors are going to be disappointed. What did you make of that final? I mean, going into them, I think it was one of the reasons it was a weird match, I think, to a lot of us was, you know, Medvedev had come in on this crazy win streak. He had absolutely blown out his quarterfinal and semifinal opponents. He beat Djokovic last time they played. I think with the odds makers, which you know, which I always say is not one guy with a cigar making a prediction. I mean, the odds makers reflect what the betting public is doing with their money. Medvedev was a favorite to win that match. He didn't win a set. What did you make of the final?
Yeah, you know, I think at the beginning of the tournament, we had our first podcast, you know, after the first week, and we talked about Djokovic and that that abdominal injury, that muscle injury that he diagnosed. And it was a big question whether or not, you know, that was going to be affecting him, if that could, you know, derail his quest for number nine in Australia. And I think in the final, he just, after everything he's been through, I mean, after the year, even, you know, going back to the US Open and the French Open, I think he really needed this. And if there was any place for him to win, it was here. And I'm not sure anything Medvedev did would have stopped him. You know, it just now, of course, it adds to Djokovic's major haul overall. And for him, there really is no place like Melbourne, even after all the different obstacles he had to go through. I think if you were Djokovic, this is how he planned it out.
If we were talking about this, I got two things I'll steal from our sort of Tennis Channel group chat. One of them was, if you're Medvedev, do you say to yourself, hey, great, I beat Rublev and I beat Tsitsipas and I'm going to another major final and Novak in Melbourne is almost at the level of Nadal in Paris, too good. Hey, I'm ranked number 3 in the world. I just turned 25 years old. Life's good. Or do you say, boy, I really was gearing up to win this thing. I thought I had Djokovic's number. He was a little bit injured. I was on this 20-match win streak. Last time I made a major final, the 2019 US Open, I pushed Nadal deep into a fifth set, and I really got outclassed in my final. When Medvedev takes inventory of this event, what are his emotions, and to what extent is he proud versus disappointed? Then the second, well, why don't we do that first, and then I'll give you a second topic we were discussing. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting perspective. I think I go back to what I said right at the beginning, which is his, you know, post-match interview, and he was asked about the big three and Djokovic and everything. And I think that perspective might give us some insight into how he'll walk away from this. Of course, I think if you're talking about straight match statistics and just if he looks back at how he played, he'll be frustrated. But I think when he looks at it overall, and he really understands the dominance and the gravity of 9 Australian Opens, I think he is sort of kind of shrugging his shoulders and just saying, you know what, too good, like you said. What are your thoughts?
I think there's a collective low threshold now for moral victories. And it's sort of like, you know what, God bless these three guys. And I think before we talk about the shortcomings of everyone else, we just need to acknowledge how good they are. Sometimes that gets shortchanged. Federer, Nadal, Djokovic are just absolutely, you know, we say generational, but there's three of them in one generation, but they're just tremendous at what they do. And they are tremendous mentally, and they are tremendous in terms of their organization during matches, and they conduct their careers like professionals. Like, let's give these guys their due before we start picking apart the competition. But I think we're at the point now as fans, and I think this trickles down to the players, where, you know what, enough of the moral victories, enough of the consolation prizes. Are you going to take one of these guys down or not? And we've all sat through, I'm getting closer, and I feel like I made some progress this tournament, and I'm pleased with how I competed. Novak was just too good. Rafa was just too good. I think we're all at the point of like, is someone going to step up and take one of these guys down, or is everyone just playing for second place here? And I think that redounds to the players. And my suspicion is, especially Medvedev, who seems much more of a sort of a plain-speaking realist, maybe, than other players. I think he says, listen, I didn't come here to get a second-place trophy, and playing as well as I did, to see it just kind of go to hell in the final. And also the way, you know, he lost that first, you know, tight first set, 5-all. Everyone's, you know, they're holding serve and a couple of shots here and there. Djokovic really did what he does so well and almost stole that first set. And then Medvedev just completely retreated. So I think some of it is a result, and some of it is the fact that he just didn't compete particularly well in the final. He lost that first set. It all went very quickly, too. I mean, some of this is about the, you know, lack of ball kids to help you towel off. But for Novak Djokovic, the 30 ball bounce between serve Novak Djokovic to play a match in a major final that was only about 2 hours, that's really remarkable. So I think some of it, to your question, I think Medvedev is disappointed. And I think some of it is he didn't leave with the big trophy. And some of it is the way he competed and didn't even get a set. I mean, the other question that we talked about, which was a bit of a hypothetical, was, I think we all kind of missed this storyline a little bit, was a lot was riding on this for Djokovic. If he doesn't win, he, you know, loses the event that he's always counted on winning. He's no longer the defending champion. It will have meant that he didn't make any inroads on this. You know, it would have been still 2017, maybe even 2017, and Nadal won. He wouldn't have made these GOAT inroads. The French Open is next, which is the event where he was, you know, barely mustered a fight against Nadal. This was a really big tournament for him. That is, as you say, you know, Melbourne is his second home, and this is where he's won half of his majors. But he really needed to win this event, and you can only imagine when he had that abdominal injury against Taylor Fritz, you can only imagine what was going through his head, which is not just, boy, now this is imperiled, but the French Open is next, and Nadal's likely to now take a four-major lead over me, and suddenly, historically, the U.S. Open looms larger. It will have been, you know, then it would have been 18 months in between majors when he's supposed to be in the prime of his career. All of which is to say is, I think we all shortchanged how big a win this was for Novak Djokovic, and now how he goes forward. He's back within two of the all-time race. He's now won 9 Australian Opens. He's only solidifies his number one ranking. This was really a big win for Novak Djokovic, especially given what happened in his last two majors.
For sure. It makes me think about something you wrote in your mailbag this week, which was the longer that the big three reign and the older that the rest of the field gets, the more pressure is put on the challengers, not the champions. And I totally agree. And I think that's why for Medvedev, he walks away from this match, yes, being disappointed, yes, being frustrated with himself. But the pressure in that match particularly, I think, was on him more so than on Djokovic, because while Djokovic needed this more than ever, and to your point, he really, it would have been a big deal had he not gotten this title. I think that he was comfortable in that space. I think when someone who's won so much in one place, and he's been there before so many times. And I think that ultimately, you know, Dominic Thiem has talked about it a little bit, but that ultimately, I think, really helps these players. Djokovic knowing that he has 5 sets if he needs it, and he's been here before, and he's taken down, you know, some of his biggest challengers. I think that just, it's a little bit of a mental edge, I just think, that really gives them, the champions, the advantage.
It's funny how, and this is also part of being a champion, it's funny how Djokovic, and, you know, Nadal is a master at this as well, how the hell they, you know, hey, the pressure's on him, it's not on me, I'm the underdog. It's funny how in the run-up to the match, Djokovic sort of was happy to pass off his opponent as the favorite. Hey, look, I've got nothing to lose. I could retire tomorrow, and it's a great career.
That's such a mental exercise, though, for them, I think.
Oh, totally. I mean, part of this is kind of organizing and just sort of managing the situation. But part of this also is, at some level, you know, and Nadal is a king at this too. Athletes tell themselves narratives, and really, I think in a lot of cases, believe them, that are in furtherance of their career, that are in service of their career. And if, you know, Nadal thinks every opponent is, he's one bad service day away from getting knocked out of the tournament, and he's convinced himself that the guy on the other side of the net is always, you know, he's going to be lucky to beat this guy, and it's served him very well. And we saw Djokovic doing a bit of the same thing. And I think the way you manage, discuss, and have a relationship with physical injury is part of that too. I mean, I'm not sure it didn't help Djokovic at some perverse level that he was playing hurt. And could always say, you know, it wasn't about my tennis, it was about my abdominal muscle, or I'm going to concentrate on, not on the situation and not even on the opponent, but I'm going to really pay attention to my body. I mean, I think the way athletes deal with injuries is part of this too. I mean, I also think you mentioned a big element to all this, which is, we say this all the time, but it doesn't, you know, doesn't make it less so. This best of three versus best of five, it's almost two different sports. I mean, it's almost like we need to just divide these into two buckets. And, you know, I know, no offense to these events, but great, you can take down Djokovic in a best of three indoor match in London, but, you know, wake me when you get him in a major. And same with, you know, great that you can, Diego Schwartzman beats Nadal in Rome. It's a great achievement, but that ain't the same as doing it in a best of five match.
I think that's what these guys do. I mean, that's the luxury they've built, is that they have the same mentality. Sure, go ahead, beat me in Rome. Sure, that's fine. Well, best of three, you know, you've got your hometown crowd behind you in some lead-up tournament, great. But when it comes down to, you know, my turf in this best of five, I think they understand that advantage. And it's become really clear. And I think the other players, because it's been discussed and it's out there, I think they realize it too. And you know, maybe it's putting extra pressure on them, like we said.
He is really good at best of three matches. Naomi Osaka. How's that for a transition?
Good one.
You know, obviously we do not have to worry about best of five on the women's side, even though, and maybe this is a discussion we have in another time. I rather like best of three, but I don't know. Maybe we need to have a bit more discussion about women playing best of five. I think they're certainly up to it physically. I mean, it wouldn't be my preference, but I am getting less and less, you know, more and more open-minded as we go. But let's talk about Naomi Osaka, who, you know, you and I talked, Jamie, after the Serena match, and I think one of the comments we talked about was Naomi Osaka took that match, and it was 4-all in the second set. She played a really lousy game and then didn't lose another point. But I don't think Naomi Osaka played the match of her life to beat Serena. She, you know, she double faulted 8 times. I mean, that's 2 games worth of double faults. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think she played top shelf. I mean, it was very functional and pragmatic, and it was, she was able to prevail without a whole lot of drama, but I don't think she even played her best against Brady in the final. And yet here she is, she's won 4 of her last 8 majors. I think rankings be damned, it's pretty obvious she's the queen of women's tennis right now. What do you make of her ascent? What do you make of her performance on in the final?
She proved in Australia, and certainly over the last few tournaments and few months, that she is as dominant a player has been over the last 2-3 years. You know, we talk about women's tennis all the time and how much it contrasts to the men's side with the big three dominating everything. And with the women, we've seen so many first-time major winners. We've seen so many people rise to the top that out of nowhere, or, you know, outside the top 10, top 20. And with Osaka, I think she's slowly but surely saying, basically, as you said, I'm number one. No one can beat me. And I think her next sort of task is going to be, of course, to win on the grass and to capture Wimbledon. But I think this is going to be the start of her almost earning that untouchable badge, if you will. I think she really proved that she's matured. She's proved that she's comfortable in the spotlight. She's proved that she can handle pressure, especially against, you know, someone like Serena, who she idolizes. So there was a lot of different challenges she faced in this tournament. And I think overall, it just encapsulates how dominant she's been over the past few years.
I almost feel bad for her, because now she has this takedown of Serena. She wins her 4th major. She's 23 years old. She wins without playing her best, and she gets her due. But then also, on Sunday, I had a former player text me, like, mark my word, she's coming after Serena's record, meaning Osaka's got 20 more of these in her. You know, I think it was in one of the press conferences, in the transcripts, you know, Mats Wilander already has her into double digits, and we're already thinking, like, you know, but boy, if she can replicate this on clay, we have our next double-digit major champion. You know, she had a nice response to that, which is kind of like, guys, easy. Let's talk about number 5 and not number 10.
Right.
But I do think there's a real sense across tennis that there's a new sheriff in town. And we do this every time, right? I mean, and it's Garbiñe Muguruza, and it's, I mean, I remember Svetlana Kuznetsova won the U.S. Open, and I think it was a Yurotikin, and I'm going to check that, in 2003, maybe? And it was sort of like, you may not know her name now, but trust me, this is a player that you're going to be hearing a lot from for the next 10 years. I mean, we always do this when we have a new champion, but this seems like a different level. You wish her well, it's all there, but who knows?
The hype train is rolling. And I mean, I think it's certainly justified, but I agree, with everyone to not jump from 5 to 10 to 20 to 23. We've got a long way to go. And I think it's going to happen regardless, but I think there are many challenges ahead for her. But that doesn't take away from what she's proven, how much she's improved, how much she's matured, and how much she's really growing into a player who seems like she will be at, you know, in this number one, number two spot for a while. And I think maybe in a year, 2 years or so, maybe the overall state of women's tennis in terms of it being so many different number ones and major winners, maybe she becomes that standard figure at the top and the rest of the people are shuffling around. Who knows?
Yeah, I think that's a good point too, because I think a lot of this optimism, yeah, it's about her results and it's about four majors now and it's about, you know, beating Serena in straight sets and a big match. But I do think a lot of this is about this leap in maturity and the fact that she really has presented herself as someone who has the constitution to be a global superstar. She's someone who has the constitution of being number one in the world without turning into a diva or somehow doing things that are adverse to her tennis. Mm-hmm. There was, I don't know if you saw the clip going around. Someone had posted the clip of her trophy presentation ceremony when she won Indian Wells in 2018. And, you know, she started out by saying this is going to be the worst speech ever. And it was someone who, you know, clearly was not especially confident or comfortable in the public situation like that. And you compare that to her speech and her graciousness and her press conferences in Australia. And I think a lot of the optimism is as much about emotional growth as it is forehands and athleticism and having a big serve. I don't know if you caught the Jen Jennifer, I resist calling it a controversy, but the meme, if you caught that. The pity of it to me was like, it was really a cool, and you know, it was a poised move to make. She just didn't stick the landing.
yeah, I know. And I think, you know, she tweeted after the fact, you know, like, I'm so sorry, I can't believe I did that. And I mentioned this last time, but you know, it's kind of endearing in a way. I think some people thought it was a dig and she was really, you know, digging the knife in, but I don't think it was. I think it might have really just been a slip, you know, something she didn't realize she did. But it just goes to show you kind of how normal she is, and she's really relatable, and I think that will only help her going forward as she kind of climbs this ladder and continues to win and continues to be in the spotlight. You know, I mean, we've seen it with so many players, and of course Serena and the big three, and they have more than ever Sharapova. I mean, there's so many people who have, become as global and as, transcending of stars as I think she's on her way to, and she's still so young. So a lot more to see and to come from Osaka, I believe.
It's really interesting too, because none of these are the same. I did a piece for Tennis Channel during the tournament, Jennifer Capriati, who won 20 years, you know, in 2001, and it was this great redemption. She was 14 years old. I mean, that's a full decade almost younger than Naomi Osaka, who was more than a decade younger than Serena. A 14-year-old is not analogous. And Serena Williams had a ton of challenges and pressures, but she also had a big sister there who could cushion that. And other players have had sort of national pressures, and Maria Sharapova, one way, she didn't make any meaningful headway against Serena, so no one really saw her. She ended up winning, you know, whatever. She won five majors, won the career slam, but no one really saw her as the number one player because there was always Serena Williams who absolutely owned her head-to-head. I mean, all of these circumstances are different, but between the sort of tri-nation, I mean, Naomi Osaka is really this multinational star, and there's an element of culture, and there's an element of race, and now we have, thanks to, you know, what happened in August, there's this social justice component. It really is, I mean, they're all unique sets of circumstances. She is going to have both advantages and challenges that no other player has had, but I just think she's really emerged in, you know, if you were buying stock in a never mind a tennis player, in a professional athlete right now, boy, is Naomi Osaka poised well on every dimension for the future. She just, yeah. I mean, she seems there. She's a commercial success. Her athleticism is tremendous and only gets better. Her win-loss record, I mean, she hasn't lost a match. And I mean, the last match she lost was at Fed Cup to Sarah Tarivas Tormo in, you know, it was basically 12 months ago. So it's all, everything's coming up roses for Naomi.
Yeah, I was going to highlight your on every dimension comment, because I think it goes beyond the tennis, which we've seen and discussed with so many players that maybe they don't have that, call it a complete package, whatever you want to call it. But she really, there are so many different levels, like you said. So if she's a stock and you're looking at all the different, you know, parts of the business, I think that, you know, for her, there's a bright future on, like you said, on so many levels.
Sidebar for 2 seconds. Were you reading at all about Fernando Tatis Jr. and his signing with the Padres?
Yeah, I mean, we had lots of stories on SI.com about it, or at least a few.
Did you catch that there was a group that had basically invested in, sort of like a venture capital firm, had basically invested in his career as if it were a stock? I mean, I think this is my sidebar, is sometimes we talk about athletes in terms of upside and payoff, and it all seems a little, you know, and who buy, sell, hold, and it all seems a little bit crass. But here was a case where a prominent athlete actually was securitized, and people who invested in Fernando Tatis Jr. are now being paid off literally, and it's not just an analogy. I wonder if this isn't something that tennis could take advantage of, because I think there are players, A, that could use the, what is in effect, startup capital. There are players that could use angel investments. And for as often as we talk about, you know, oh, I want to put all my money on Felix, or I want to load up on, you know, whatever, Coco Gauff. I wonder if there isn't a market like this for tennis players.
It would be
interesting. That's my sidebar for the day.
It would be interesting.
It would, right?
I think the company or the firm, they use like an algorithm, right? And it talks about the performance and the earning potential and everything. And so it's interesting, of course, we always talk about the difference between team sport and an individual sport. And so for tennis, it would be really interesting, for one, being an individual sport, two, such a global sport with so many different players from all over the world, and three, because the structure of the tours and the majors and the scheduling, and we always talk about you know, how draining and how injuries are so common because of how long the 2 week off season of tennis. I mean, so many things as compared to your example with baseball are so different. So it would be really interesting, very, very intriguing exercise for tennis.
And you know, and then the other thing I would say is what we've seen vividly over the past year is players need the money. You know, the same way that your entrepreneurial startup and that your tech idea needs financing as well. If you're not a top 10 player, I mean, I was impressed, happy, and surprised by, for example, the big names that have been playing, that played the simultaneous event last week at Melbourne Park, this Phillip Island Trophy, and, you know, Sofia Kenin and Andreescu and, you know, Petra Martic. And sure, that was about matches, but also there are clearly players who are thinking in terms of, I haven't been paid a lot lately. I need these earning opportunities. I think there are a lot of players that might be open to that idea, just because if you're not a top 10 player, you're thinking about your finances and you might need, you know, again, the equivalent of startup capital. Anyway, let's spin forward. We have a, you know, we have a full slate of events. This week, we just had the entry list for the Miami Open, which will go on. It will not be played on the big football stadium. It will have a significant reduction in prize money because of the drop in attendance. But the good news is, you know, there will be a big event. Roger Federer is scheduled to play. Nadal, Djokovic. I mean, tennis persists. Any thoughts on what this sport should look like, will look like, and where this is going in the time of COVID before we get to get to the French Open, the next major?
Yeah, it should be interesting. You know, as you said, the Miami Open will continue. They won't be in Hard Rock Stadium, but they will have fans, I think, is what I read. I'm not sure how many, but they will have fans. So I think it's going to be interesting. Obviously, the U.S. Open was completely without fans. And so as the tour continues on in the spring and as we, you know, gear up for the majors, and I think as these players travel more and as the, you know, during the summer, there's a lot of back-to-back tournaments. I think it's just going to be, you know, I think as we see with other sports with, you know, you've got people on the COVID reserve list or, you know, so-and-so is in quarantine or whatever it is. I think we're going to start to see some of that on the tour as players continue to travel. And I think one of the big points that is also interesting with tennis is just that everyone's sort of on their own. You know, the team plane is not flying to the Miami Open. I'm sure a lot of players will travel together coming from the same places as they normally do. But that lack of that team experience and then that team safety, I think will be an interesting factor as the schedule kind of moves on throughout this year.
We can only hope that Pfizer and Moderna keep doing their thing, because I mean, the other point there is just different players come from different countries with different right. COVID rates and different policies, and different events are held in different countries with different COVID rates and different policies. So yeah, it'll, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens when we get to Western Europe. I think it'll be interesting to see what happens at the French Open is, it's on the books. It's going to happen. I think it's just a question of circumstance. And I think the same to some extent at Wimbledon as well. Will there be, you know, we did not, and neither did ESPN broadcast from Melbourne. There was, you know, obviously not a full complement of fans. I don't know when we will have a full complement of fans. I don't know how you feel about even the U.S. Open. I don't know, Jay. I mean, you and I live in the area. Are we 6 months away from, you know, 800,000 fans over 14 days going to a tennis event? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about that in terms of the Olympics, which of course is still, I guess, in the balance, although as far as we know so far, it's still on. So I think that's the other big thing on the tennis calendar that always impacts tournaments and player schedules and decision-making. And so, again, I'm not sure. I am a little bit hesitant about the Olympics and attending, only because of what we've heard in terms of quarantine periods and sort of restrictions for people, you know, for media people at least, but also for athletes. So I don't know. It was very strange to see fans in Australia, but you were taking that with a grain of salt, so to speak, because knowing the situation there versus here. So I don't know. 6 months is a long time, but I'm not sure if a full U.S. Open with fans is the best approach, at least for now.
We will have someone on USTA next week, and we'll talk about that. I also think, as we close up and await our next Zooms, I do think the Olympics will be really interesting to see which tennis players show up and which don't. I heard from an agent that some players are trying to have, you know, the Olympics are included sometimes in contracts and endorsement contracts. They expect players to play the majors and the Olympics. even without, I mean, even though you can't necessarily have branding and passages that you ordinarily would. But why did tennis players play the Olympics? I mean, for different reasons. And sometimes, you know, tennis players are the flag bearers, and sometimes, you know, it's patriotism. But I think a lot of it is for the experience and for the camaraderie and for the, you know, it's just the Olympics are so different from a run-of-the-mill tour event. Well, if you can't have fans and you're going to have all these COVID protocols, and again, the vast majority of the Japanese population doesn't even want the Olympics to be staged, this is not going to be the fun, happy,
exactly,
Sydney, Athens, London, to some extent Rio games. This is going to be a different kind of Olympics. And I wonder, you know, does picking a name out of the hat, you know, does Serena Williams really want to go through this, given the absence of fans and given, you know, that the athlete's village is not going to be the athlete's village in COVID times. So it's going to be interesting to see what, you know, a year ago, we were all talking about eligibility and which players could possibly get left off. And it was just an assumption that sort of every player, I think Dominic Thiem notwithstanding, you know, every top player was going to show up. I don't know if that's going to be the case in 2021. We shall see. Anyway, Jamie, always a pleasure. I know you have to run, I have to run. But good to catch up, and let's do another one of these next week.
Definitely. Sounds good. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you to Jamie, as always, for her conversation. Thanks to you for listening. Again, we will have a USTA guest next week, but keep the suggestions coming. iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe, leave a review. It always helps. And have a good week, everyone. Take care.